WMNF Tampa.
Good morning and welcome to True Talk. This is your host Samar Jarrah. My co-host Ahmed Bedir is not here today. He is celebrating Thanksgiving with his family. And to those of you who celebrate, enjoy the day and enjoy being with your friends and family. You're going to be listening today to an interview I conducted during the COVID times with Dr. Rashid Al-Khaldi. He's a Palestinian-American historian of the Middle East. He was born in the U.S. When his father was working at the United Nations. He's the author of many, many interesting books. I remember vividly a book that I studied or read when I was doing my master's at USF a while ago. It's called Brokers of Deceit. It's called Sowing Crisis, The Cold War and American Dominance in the Middle East. Another book that I enjoyed is Brokers of Deceit, How the U.S. Has Undermined Peace in the Middle East. Today, we're going to be talking about his latest book. It's called The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance. Fascinating book. It covers, I think, the area of Palestine from 1917 to 2017. If you have any questions or comments, please send them to dj@wmnf.org, to dj@wmnf.org. And remember, it's a recorded show that I did a while ago. I want to thank Frank so much for being at WMNF station today during Thanksgiving. And thank you for helping me produce this show. And also thank you, Patty Perkey, for helping with putting this show together. Enjoy your day. Welcome back to True Talk. This is your host, Samar Jarrah. And as promised, told you, we're going to be having a lovely live interview with Professor Rashid Khalidi. He is the author of 7 books, among them Palestinian Identity, Brokers of Deceit, The Iron Cage,
His writings has appeared in the New York Times, Boston Globe, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, and many academic journals. He is the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University, New York, and he is the co-editor of the Journal of Palestine Studies. Today, we're going to be talking about a fascinating book. I finished reading it last night, and it's called The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917-2017. If you have any questions, please send them to dj@wmnf.org. Good morning, Professor Khalidi. I need to put Professor Khalidi on the air. Good morning, Professor Khalidi. I hope you were listening to the introduction.
I was. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to have you. It's an honor, actually. I just finished reading your book yesterday, and I have not stopped thinking about it. I thought I know a lot as a Palestinian myself and somebody who read three of your books when I was doing my master's at USF. But obviously, education never ends and never stops. I want to start by asking you, why did you write this book? Because as I just told you, I read three of yours, and they're different, and I read them in the context of studying for my master's and trying to read more of academic books. So why did you write this book, and it's your seventh or eighth?
I wrote it at the urging, among others, of my son, who said to me that I had written enough academic books. I mean, the books that you read and the books that you used for your MA probably were among those books that were mainly written for specialists, for historians, for people who are knowledgeable about the topic. And what he said to me was, it's time for you to write something that is accessible to readers who are not experts or not academics. And it's time for you to include some of the stories that you tell us, some of the family stories that you tell us, or some of the things that you yourself have experienced, and to use a different voice. So I tried to do that. I mean, I had other people urging me to do it. And so it is, you're right, it is a different kind of book than anything I've written before.
I think what I liked is the fact that you have narrated some of your own family history, which goes back to Jerusalem in particular. And I really had no idea that your uncle was the first one to correspond with Theodor Herzl. Maybe you were going to be talking...
Great uncle,
yeah. Yes, you're very young, sorry.
The uncle of my grandfather.
Oh my gosh, okay. Sorry about that.
Okay.
So, but I'm going to go back to the introduction, because I think really the whole juice of the book and the jumping board of the book comes in the introduction, but I'm going to go back to it later on. This is a long book, and it's extensive and has so many issues. There is no way we can cover it all. So maybe what you can do to help our listeners to understand is, if you could, like, in 5 minutes, summarize the six wars that were launched on Palestine, and then I'm going to be asking specific questions.
Sure. I tried to approach this with an American reader in mind, or American or European reader in mind, and with the ideas that they have that I think are entirely false about Palestine. Most of them think of this as a struggle, at best, between two peoples, both of which have some rights in the land, and which are more or less equals. And most people would then favor the Israelis because of the biblical connection. I try and show in this book that this is a completely incorrect view. Yes, there are two peoples, of course, but they're not on a basis of equality. First of all, because this is and always was a colonial struggle, in which first the Zionist movement and then later the State of Israel were fully supported by the greatest power of the age, whether that was Great Britain during the era of colonialism through World War II, or whether that was the United States or other great powers like Britain, France, and the Soviet Union at different times since World War II. So that's the first thing I try and show. This is not just a struggle between two peoples. This is a struggle to implant an entirely new group of mainly Europeans, who have a claim, obviously, in their eyes to this land, and to supplant, replace the indigenous population, which, of course, has a natural right of self-determination according to the the United Nations Charter, even according to the Covenant of the League of Nations, right after World War One. So that's the second thing I'm trying to show, that this is a struggle to implant what described itself as a settler colonial movement. When you say, you know, Zionism is a settler colonial movement, people get up in arms. Well, early Zionists, Herzl himself, Zev Jabotinsky, David Ben-Gurion, had no qualms about saying, yes, we are coming here to settle. We have a claim here. This is our ancestral homeland, they would argue. But, yes, of course, we're here coming as Europeans to bring progress to this backwards country. The people who are here don't have rights. We're the only ones who have rights. But we're being backed by a colonial power. We are a colonial movement. And the major institutions of the Zionist movement describe themselves as colonial. Mm-hmm. The Jewish Colonization Agency was the funding agency that bought up the very small proportion of land of Palestine, about 5 or 6%, that the Zionist movement managed to purchase before 1948. So I describe six wars, six phases of this, what was really an assault on the Palestinians to deprive them of their rights and to replace them with another people. The first of which started with the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which basically declared that the Palestinians don't exist as a people, and the only people in Palestine with national rights is the Jewish people. And that war was carried out by the British Army, mainly, in the late 1930s, when they crushed a Palestinian revolt. The second phase started with the partition resolution, which gave most of a country that was inhabited primarily by Arabs to a Jewish minority, and which was carried out, in that case, mainly by first Zionist militias, and then after the establishment of the State of Israel on May 15, 1948, by the Israeli army, but with the indispensable support of both the United States and the Soviet Union. That war could not have been waged without the declaration of war that the United States and the Soviet Union pushed through the United Nations General Assembly in November 1947. I then talk about several other phases, the 1967 war, I talk about the 1982 war, and I talk about how both of those were not just Israeli wars, mm-hmm. or Israeli wars with Arab states in the case of 1967, or an Israeli invasion of Lebanon in the case of 1982. They were collaborations between the United States and Israel, where the Israeli leaders went to Washington, asked for permission, told the Americans they were going to go ahead, told the United States they were going to go ahead. In the case of 1967, the head of the Mossad goes and talks to Secretary of Defense McNamara, talks to the president. In the case of 1982, Defense Minister Sharon goes to Washington, talks to Secretary of State Haig, and they get a green light. So these are American-Israeli declarations of war, I argue. And I talk then about the 1993 Oslo Accords, as another declaration of war, and I talk about the current situation leading up to the Trump plan as the sixth of these declarations of war on the Palestinians.
Let me just remind our listeners that this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. You can follow this conversation on Twitter from my feed, Samar D. Jarrah. We are also on Facebook / True Talk, and we're talking to Professor Rashid Khalidi, the 100 Years War on Palestine. I want to go to the introduction, Professor, and I'm going to read from page 12. And this is Jabotinsky, and he wrote in 1923, and you say that he is one of the most honest, probably Zionist, who really wrote about what is in plan for Palestine. And here I am quoting from the book what Jabotinsky wrote. He's one of the leading Zionist thinkers of the time. And now, every native population in the world resists colonists as long as it has the slightest hope of being able to rid itself of the danger of being colonized. That is what the Arabs in Palestine are doing, and what they will persist in doing as long as there remains a solitary spark of hope that they will be able to prevent the transformation of Palestine into the land of Israel. Later, he said, Zionist colonization can proceed and develop only under the protection of a power that is independent of the native population, behind an iron wall which the native population cannot breach. I think this is the jumping board of your book. Since that day, and actually since the first war in 1917, the Zionist movement realized that it needed a superpower to achieve its colonial project. Can you elaborate on that and who they started with?
Absolutely. Jabotinsky is not just any old Zionist leader. He is the intellectual father and the founder of the current of what's called revisionist Zionism, to which belonged Menachem Begin, Yitzhak Shamir, Ariel Sharon, and to which belongs Benjamin Netanyahu, four of the most important prime ministers of Israel, are followers of Jabotinsky. So Jabotinsky is an extremely important figure in the history of Zionism. His ideas and his inspiration have guided Israeli governments at least since Begin became prime minister in 1977. And I think this is the point that you, the second of the quotes that you read is really important, because it highlights the fact that this is not an independent movement that's acting on its own.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movement that could not have achieved what it has achieved without the support of an external power. And this was something that was realized from the very beginning. This is why Herzl, Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern political Zionism, goes around the chancelleries of Europe trying to get the support of France, of Germany, of the Ottoman Empire. It's why his successor, Chaim Weizmann, who later becomes the first president of Israel, spent so much effort and time gaining the support of Great Britain for the Balfour Declaration. And it's why Ben-Gurion and his colleagues in the 30s and 40s expend enormous effort, in fact, even before the 30s and 40s, in developing support for Zionism in the United States and also at the same time in the Soviet Union. And it all pays off at different times, this solicitation of support by a great power to make possible the achievement of Zionist aims and later on to make possible the successes of the State of Israel. It doesn't fight the wars that it fights with its own weapons. It fights these wars with, in the case of the 1948 war, American and Soviet weapons, in the case of the 1956 and 67 wars with French and British weapons, and since then, mainly with American weapons. So that external support is absolutely crucial to the implantation of the Zionist project in Palestine and to the success later on of the State of Israel.
I just finished reading a book called All the Real Indians Died Off, Professor, and they talk about erasure and the fact that how history, when written and rewritten in the U.S., they erased the Native Americans and created myths. And I think it somehow, the whole time that I was reading your book, that book came to mind. You mentioned Balfour Declaration and the 1922 League of Nations mandate, that they totally erased the Palestinians. Can you elaborate on that?
Right. This is an important part of any colonial settler. To physically, as much as possible, physically erase the indigenous population, to eliminate the names as much as possible and substitute names drawn from the tree, and to try to rewrite history so that it becomes instead of a history of a struggle between an indigenous people and a colonizer, a struggle of a triumphant creation of an entirely new entity. So and that's the way American history is written. The Native Americans are a footnote. Just as slavery is a footnote. We pontificate about our democracy in the United States, and we think of the Senate and the House meeting in the Capitol. The Capitol is a building built by slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
The White House is a building built by slave labor. The lands on which these monuments are established originally belonged to Native Americans. And we erase, as you say, that history. Similarly, Zionism has done the same thing. There was a commission that was established right after 1948 war, right after the establishment of the state, to rename places. These are places that had Arab names. These are places that people had lived in for centuries or millennia. They were renamed. Every mountain, every river, every locality got a new name. And to some extent, we've done the same thing in this country, or in Australia, or in New Zealand, or in Canada. Not every name has been changed, obviously, here or there, whether in Israel or in the United States. But, we have names drawn from colonial history. New York, New Jersey. This is not Native American names. Those are names drawn from Great Britain, whence most of the colonists originally came. So this process of erasure is central to what a colonizing project does.
So how did they do it with the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations mandate? How did they exactly do it?
Well, here you're talking about legal erasure. You're talking about Great Britain issuing a statement in November of 1917 at the height of World War I, in which it says that Palestine is a country in which Britain looks to establishing what it called a Jewish national home. And basically said that for the Jewish people, and thereby, while at the same time not mentioning the Palestinians, who were the 95% of the population. The rest of the declaration says the non-Jewish communities would get civil and religious rights. Well, what that declaration says is there is one people with national rights in Palestine. That's the Jewish people. And therefore, there's one people with rights, with political rights. And the rest of the population, the overwhelming majority, doesn't exist as a national entity, has no national rights, and in fact has no political rights. It specifically says they're to have civil and religious rights. The 1922 mandate for Palestine that the League of Nations gives to Britain repeats the wording of the Balfour Declaration in its preamble and then amplifies in several of its main how this Jewish national home is to be established. And again, never mentions the Palestinians. The overwhelming majority of the population that Britain is getting a mandate to govern don't have any rights, whereas the tiny minority, which Britain is favoring, get lavish attention in the mandate as to how they're supposed to be established in the land, as to how they're supposed to have governmental institutions, as to how they're to be given this and that assistance by the magnitude of power. So the Palestinians are, in effect, erased in this document. They're also erased in other documents. The famous November 1967 Security Council Resolution 242, which was supposed to be the basis for peace after the 1967 war, also doesn't mention the Palestinians. They are erased in that document. There's no mention of Palestinian rights, of the Palestinian state, of the Palestinians. The only mention of them is indirect and without mentioning their name, talking about a just resolution of the refugee problem. They don't even deign to say which refugees and who for.
I want to talk about the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, because whenever, Professor, we have, and I mean by we as Palestinians, have a debate with somebody on the other side, not necessarily Jewish, but pro-Israel, would say you lost the war in 1948, and Israel had to do what it had to do because of the Arab armies that marched into Israel. You refused the partition plan. But in your book, you say that throughout, maybe from 1917 till the establishment of the State of Israel, Britain was a vicious power, killing the Palestinians and stifling the resistance that started with your great-great-uncle's letter to Theodore Herzl. Can you address that part in particular and the ethnic cleansing of Palestine that was happening under the auspices of the British?
Right. Well, what the British did was particularly important, because when the Palestinians finally had enough of being treated as second-class citizens, even though they were a majority in their own country, and they rose up against British rule starting in 1936, the British brought in a huge military force, over 100,000 soldiers. At that time, there were about 300,000 adult male Palestinian Arabs in the country. So there's one soldier or policeman for every three Palestinian adult males. A huge force when you think about it. And they used all kinds of means. They brought in the Royal Air Force, they brought in artillery, tanks, and so on. And they killed, wounded, exiled, or imprisoned about 1 in 10 Palestinian Arab males. So they completely crushed the resistance to the Palestinians. And they did this in a variety of particularly cruel manners. People were executed for the possession, and some are summarily executed for the possession of one bullet, for example. Homes were demolished on suspicion of terrorism. Many of these wounded fighters captured on the battlefield were simply shot in many cases. Raids were carried out in which people's food was destroyed, their homes were damaged, their clothing was ruined, and as punitive measures. A man named Lord Wingate established what were called night squads to carry out raids on villages that were suspected of harboring rebels. And of course, most villages, according to the British, the chief of the Imperial General Staff wrote a memo which he said everybody supports this rebellion. So any village could have this happen to them. These night squads, which were composed of members of Zionist militias that Wingate and other British officers were training, would go into these villages and blow up houses and kill people. This method finally suppressed the rebellion by 1939, but it broke the back of Palestinian resistance. And it made possible what happened in 1947 after the partition resolution was passed by the United Nations, giving most of Palestine to the minority, the Jewish population, for a Jewish state. And by the early spring of 1948, before the State of Israel was established, before the British army left, before any Arab army had entered into Palestine, these militias were already on the offensive, and they had taken by May 15th, by the date on which the State of Israel is established and the British finally left, they had taken all three of the three most important urban centers of Palestinian life. They had taken Jaffa, they had taken Haifa, and they had taken the Arab districts of West Jerusalem, expelling over 150,000 city dwellers. In other words, the urban population of Palestine was ethnically cleansed before the State of Israel even came into being, mm-hmm. and before any Arab army had come in to the country. There had, by the time the actual war between the Arab states and Israel began, Israel had forced 300,000 people, about 150,000 village dwellers and 150,000 urbanites from their homes, had emptied those areas of Arab population, and had taken areas not only that were allotted to the Jewish state under partition, but areas like Jaffa and areas to the west of Jerusalem that were supposed to be part of an Arab state that was never allowed to come into being. And that was the beginning of a process of ethnic cleansing. The Arab armies then enter on May 15th to attempt to stem this hemorrhage. They fail. The Israeli army in the end proves to be much stronger than the Arab armies combined. And I go into some of the reasons for that in the book. But in that process, another 400,000 Palestinians are driven from their homes in places like Lidda and Ramli, in villages in Galilee, in areas all over the country. People are either forced out at gunpoint, or a few people are massacred in order to force people to leave, or villages are bombarded, or scare tactics are used, whispering campaigns, propaganda, and people are scared and for their lives, and they have no defense, and they leave. So a majority of Palestine's 1.3 million Arabs are driven from their homes and then later on not allowed to return as part of this process of ethnic cleansing, which starts before the State of Israel is established, while the British army is still there, and before any Arab army has crossed into Palestine.
If you're just joining us, this is True Talk on WMNF 88.5 FM. We are live in the studio, and we are talking to Professor Rashid Khalidi, a Palestinian-American professor. He is the author of The 100 Years War on Palestine. And if you have any questions, please send them to dj@wmnf.org. We are live on Facebook, on the WMNF different channels, as well as True Talk. And on Twitter, I want to move, Professor, to 1956, 1967, when the U.S. became involved. In 1956, the U.S. kind of stopped Israel, Britain, and France, the attack on Egypt. However, in 1967, things have changed dramatically. Britain is no longer the superpower Jabotinsky was looking for. Now it is replaced by one of the most powerful superpowers on the face of Earth. Can you tell us how this shift happened and why the U.S. is so bent on launching wars on the Palestinians?
Well, it's a complicated story, because the Zionist movement relied entirely on Britain for the first couple of decades during the Palestine mandate of the League of Nations. But by the time World War II comes around, in the lead-up to war, the British realize that they have a problem on their hands. They're about to have to fight Germany and Italy. And that is likely going to major arena of the war. The British are going to have to fight in a region inhabited by Arabs with an army, an Indian army, which has a huge Muslim contingent. Mm-hmm. And Britain has alienated Arabs and Muslims and many other people in the Third World by their brutal suppression of Palestine, 36-39. And so I bring up internal British government documents talking about the fact that this is an Indian problem. This is a problem of the British Empire in India. This is a strategic problem. We're supporting the Zionists. We're crushing the Palestinians. We are blackening our name in this part of the world where we are going to fight and where we have armies, the Egyptian army, the Iraqi army, and most importantly, the British Indian army, who are alienated from us and who we're going to need in this war that's coming with Germany and with Italy. And so Britain changes course. They issue what is called the White Paper of 1939, in which they limit Jewish immigration, and they take other measures, which, from the point of view of the Zionists, but the leadership of the Zionist movement had taken to heart Jabotinsky's injunction to find an iron wall. And they had been working very carefully and very intelligently on finding alternative sponsors, as it were, for their project, both in the United States and in the Soviet Union, such that when the break with the British comes after the White Paper, they have the support already of Washington and later on of Moscow. And this is crucial. Britain has won the war, but sort of lost, in a certain sense, its primacy to the United States. The United States and the Soviet Union are the new superpowers. Mm-hmm. And the Zionist movement had intelligently foreseen that and had planned for that. And the planning goes way back. It turns out that people like David Ben-Gurion, who becomes the first prime minister of Israel, and Yitzhak Ben-Zvi, who becomes, I think, the second president of the state of Israel, had been working assiduously in the United States way back during World War I to build up support among the Jewish community and among American politicians for the Zionist project. And this all comes to fruition after World War II. Later on, during the 50s, Israel reestablishes relations with Britain. It establishes very good relations also with France. France is a colonial power, trying to maintain its colonial possessions in the Middle East, in Algeria and Tunisia and Morocco. And it's opposed to Arab nationalism. And Israel plays on that. The Israeli government tells the French, we can help you against the Egyptian nationalists who are supporting rebels in your territories. They say the same thing to the British, and the British come around after being alienated from Zionism. The British come around, and both of these powers support the Suez War, which is an attack by Britain, France, and Israel on Egypt in October 1956. The Israelis make a mistake there, because getting the support of Britain and France enables them to win the war, but they sort of lose politically. Mm-hmm. Because the United States and the Soviet Union come down like a ton of bricks on the British and the French. They say this is a colonial war designed to maintain illegitimate things like control of Egypt by Britain and France, control of the Suez Canal by Britain and France, control of Egypt's government and its wealth. And neither superpower goes along with this. And so they force the British and the French to leave Egypt, and they also force the Israelis to withdraw from the territories that they occupied, which included the Gaza Strip and the Sinai Peninsula. And the Israelis learned that lesson. They never again go to war without taking the permission and getting the support
of a superpower.
Exactly.
So how Resolution 242 that the PLO and so many Arab countries and the international community always or used to stress on the Palestinians to accept it. However, when you dissect it and you look at it in your book, you think it was a sanction and another erasure of the Palestinians. Could you just elaborate a little bit on that? Because
sure.
That was a request actually coming to me from the Arab world because they were kind of surprised when I talked about it in the past few days.
Well, 242 is a very important turning point. Because with 242, what Israel and the United States managed to do is to shift the conversation. Until the June War of 1967, the discussion had been on Palestine in 1947, the rights of the Palestinians and the rights of Israel, the return of refugees who had been driven out in 1948, and all of these questions are swept under the rug. But 242 is just about dealing with the consequences of the 1967 war. Israel occupied territory of Egypt, Syria, and the areas of the West Bank and Gaza that were administered by Egypt and by Jordan and Egypt, respectively. And 242 simply deals with the consequences of 67. It sweeps under the rug things that the United Nations had urged, like return of refugees. There's a resolution of the General Assembly in December 1948, which calls for the return and the compensation of all Palestinian refugees. It sweeps under the rug the rights of the Palestinians to have a state in their homeland, which the partition resolution called for. The partition resolution of November 1947 had called for, and so on. So 242 is important in that regard, and it's important in another regard because, as I mentioned, it doesn't mention the Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
The Palestine question, the issue of Palestinian rights, the return of Palestinian refugees, none of this finds a place in 242. 242 simply talks about an exchange of land for peace, but it does so in a way particularly favorable to Israel, because Israel is not obliged immediately to withdraw in exchange for peace or in exchange for anything. Israel is enabled by 242 to remain as it has since 1967. We're now, June has passed. We've now had 53 years of Israeli occupation of the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and occupied Arab East Jerusalem, and the Syrian Golan Heights. And the United Nations hasn't done a thing about it, nor has anybody else. So 242 was basically a license for Israel to occupy and colonize. In practice, that's what it has amounted to. And it seems to me a completely unsuitable basis for a settlement if the settlement has to involve things like a just resolution of the Palestine question and an ending to a military occupation under which people have suffered for going on three generations now.
In your book, Professor, you are quite critical of the PLO and the Yasser Arafat, especially during the Oslo Agreement, but even before that. And I think one of the most important things that you mentioned, how many professors like yourself and Edward Said and Abu Lughod, a lot of people who lived in the U.S. tried for the past maybe 20 to 30, if not more, 40 years, to try to convince the resistance and the PLO representatives of the Palestinians the importance of America, not America, the administration and diplomatically only, but the people. Why they never saw that the way the Zionists, like you said, from the days of before the establishment of the State of Israel? I think even Golda Meir was living in the U.S. trying to get support for that colonial project.
Golda Meir was born in Milwaukee. She's an American. She was an American originally before she emigrated to Palestine. Well, I mean, there are many reasons. First of all, I am very critical of leaderships, not just the PLO, but earlier Palestinian leaderships as well, even though I understand and I try and explain the very difficult uphill struggle that they were having to wage. I mean, I don't say that it was an easy task to deal with the issues that they had to deal with, whether in the 20s and the 30s or the PLO leadership in the 60s and the 70s and afterwards. However, I do say that I think they didn't have an understanding of the global situation that was anything like on the level of the understanding of the Zionist movement. And that's understandable, given the fact that most Zionist leaders were themselves originally Europeans and Americans. Mm-hmm. I mean, David Ben-Gurion comes to Palestine from the Russian Empire. Others come from the Habsburg Empire. Others come from the United States or other parts of Europe. So they are Europeans and Americans. They know the societies from which they originally come. And they come to serve the Zionist movement, they come to be leaders of the Zionist movement, but they speak English, French, and German, and Russian as their native tongue, even as they come to speak Hebrew as a national language. So for them, understanding the United States, or understanding Britain or France or whatever, comes naturally, comes easily. In many cases, they are citizens of the countries we're talking about. Chaim Weizmann was a British subject. He had been nationalized as a British subject. So when he talked to Lord Balfour, or he talked to David Lloyd George, he was talking to him as a fellow Brit.
Mm-hmm.
And Golda Meir could talk in English to Americans, in American, in, you know, Midwestern accented English to American politicians, and so on and so forth. Palestinians did not have that advantage, and still don't. I mean, it's changing now.
But, till this now? Till now?
Well, I think it's now changing. I think you now have people, the generation of Palestinian Americans who were born and grew up in the United States, and they're as American as anybody else, and they understand how the system works here. And they understand how to address Americans, and they understand the American system of government and the Constitution.
But
and
it's
they
still,
understand their rights.
But it's still not the the representatives like the Palestinian Authority. It's still people on their own and organizations like BDS, although it is centered in the inside the state of Israel and Palestine. But it is still individual efforts, not...
That's true.
Yeah.
That's true. And I think that the PLO and the PA and Palestinian official representatives are still got a very long way to go before they understand the importance of speaking directly to Americans, or for that matter, of speaking directly to Israelis and speaking to them in a way that's understandable, putting forward a Palestinian position that people can understand and support. We don't understand the degree to which this is a global issue, and you have to be able to address those global audiences in a language they will understand.
I hope now
the Zionist movement never had a problem with that.
No, and I hope now with Black Lives Matter and all that is happening now in the U.S., they can realize how it is important to create alliances. And you do mention in the book that we need to pay attention to China, to India, to third world countries, to Latin America, and everybody we can talk to. But I really want you to spend a few minutes on Oslo, because some people really think in the West that this was the most brilliant thing that ever happened to the Palestinians. Yet to me, I think it is another Nakba and another Nexa that happened. Could you tell us why it's you see it in such a negative view?
Well, the Accords of 1993 that were signed on the White House lawn in the presence of President Clinton and Israeli Prime Minister Rabin and PLO leader Yasser Arafat were the result of a whole series of negotiations. In my book, I go into some depth in talking about this, and I've actually written another book about it. And I show that the ceiling for what the Palestinians would be allowed to get had been established long before the Oslo Accords were signed on the White House lawn in September 1993. They had been set by agreement between the United States, Israel, and Egypt, back at the time of the Camp David Accords of 1978 and the Egyptian-Israeli Peace Treaty of 1979 that followed. At that time, Israeli Prime Minister Begin managed to impose on the Egyptians, on the Americans, his understanding of what was acceptable. And what was acceptable was that Israel had the right to settle and colonize any part of the occupied territories that it chose to do that in, and that the Palestinians were to have no national or political rights or existence. There was to be no Palestinian state. There was to be no Palestinian sovereignty. The maximum that the Palestinians were to be allowed was autonomy. And this was embodied in a series of formal international agreements between these countries. And so the United States is basically conceded to Israel long before Oslo in 1978-79. The limitations that were later on imposed on the negotiating process. I was involved as an advisor to the Palestinian delegation in the negotiations that preceded the Oslo negotiations. These are the ones that emerged from the Madrid Peace Conference of 1991 and that continued in Washington at the State Department during 1992 and 1993 until the summer of 1993. And in those negotiations, what we learned was that the parameters that had been laid down in 1978, whereby the Palestinians could not have a state, could not have self-determination, could not have sovereignty, could not have control over Jerusalem, could not have control over water or airspace or entry and exit or the population register or many other things, the settlement would be that Israeli colonization was absolutely allowed and could not be limited. We found out those limits, and we refused to go along. The PLO leadership, unfortunately, failed to understand this, sent unqualified negotiators to Oslo behind the backs of the people who were negotiating in Washington, and negotiated the Oslo Accords, which enshrined the things that I'm talking about, essentially enshrined the parameters that Begin had imposed in 1978-79. So when one sees an outcome decades after the 1993 Oslo Accords, whereby there is no Palestinian state, whereby Israeli settlement has metastasized such that there are now 600-something thousand, 650,000 mm-hmm. Israeli settlers in the occupied West Bank and occupied Arab East Jerusalem, this is the natural outcome of what Begin intended and what was negotiated at Oslo in 1993 and in subsequent accords in 1995 and afterwards.
And the U.S. was sponsoring a peace process that never ends. But I think one of the worst things that you mention in the book is that this national movement for liberation ended up being the police of the colonizers. Isn't that correct?
Right.
The PA was policing. I want to move to the deal of the century and Trump. How is it different than Oslo? And what do you think is going to happen with all this news about annexing the rest of the West Bank?
I think that the deal of the century is, and it's another joint declaration of war. It's not an Israeli declaration of war this time. It's an Israeli-American or an American-Israeli declaration of war. Because what it essentially argues is that Israel can do whatever it pleases. It can act as it wants. It can limit Palestinian rights as much as it wants, can get everything it wants in the occupied territories, does not have to end its military occupation. The misnomer for this is security control. Israel retains overall security control over the entirety of Palestine between the river and the sea. It signifies an American formal public approval of these aims. Now, secretly, the United States has been on board with these things, in my view, since 1978. I think that's what Camp David mm-hmm. and the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty and the bilateral letters between the United States and Israel at that time signify, that the United States is surreptitiously and quietly accommodating itself to whatever Israel wants. The Trump plan makes this public and says openly, the United States supports exactly what Israel's maximalist objectives are. And in that respect, it is a step. It is a major step. What will come of annexation? I don't know. The parameters of the specifics of that, we'll find out maybe in the next few weeks or maybe not until later. But the Netanyahu government wants to take advantage of the fact that they have in the White House an administration, in Washington, an administration that is willing to go much farther in terms of openly endorsing Israeli objectives that the United States has surreptitiously accepted for decades. They're supremely sensitive to American public opinion. They realize that at this point in time, it does not look as if President Trump is assured of a second term. And so they want to get what they can while they can.
I just want to read again the title of your book and remind our listeners that we're talking to Rashid Khalidi. The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance. I want you to address the resistance. I don't think Jabotinsky got what he wanted. I don't think the Palestinians have lost hope. And you talked about the intifadas, the first one and the second. I personally don't think that Palestinians will just disappear and be erased. What do you think? Do you think there would be another intifada? Could you address the resistance out of all these six wars by superpowers, different superpowers and international institutions? They're still there. They're still resisting.
Right. Earlier on in the book, I talk about different cases of settler colonialism. And obviously, Israel is a different case because, for one thing, most settler colonial projects are extensions of a mother country. So British settlement in North America was an extension of the actions of the British Crown. French settlement in Canada or in Algeria was an extension of the French mother country, of the French state. Similarly, most settler colonial movements are linked to a mother country. Zionism is different in that respect. Zionism does not represent the United States or Britain. It represents itself. It represents a movement of Jews who believe that they could not live safely in Europe because of its anti-Semitism, and that they had to establish a national entity of their own in their ancestral homeland, in what they call the Land of Israel. So it's different in that respect. And it's different in that it did not retain a connection to a mother country, but rather looked to the establishment of an independent entity, a state. Herzl doesn't say in 1897, when he writes a book, the Jewish extension of British or German colonialism. He says a Jewish state. It is to be backed and supported by external powers, but it is to be its own independent entity. So that's another way in which Zionism is different. But I say that all settler colonial movements ultimately have to deal with the indigenous population. Some of them deal with them by eliminating them as much as possible. Now, there are still many million Native Americans in the United States. They still exist. They mm-hmm. still resist. They still retain some of their rights. The same is true with the First Nations in Canada. The same is true with the Maori in New Zealand. And the same is true with the original populations of Australia. But in these four cases, these populations have been overwhelmed by numbers that essentially drowned overwhelmed them. That didn't happen in other settler colonies. It didn't happen in South Africa. It didn't happen in Kenya or other places in East Africa where there was European settler colonialism. And it didn't happen in Algeria. And I'm arguing in this book that it hasn't happened in Palestine. The Zionist movement has been successful, as were other settler colonial movements, in setting up a new national entity. The United States is a settler colonial project which was successful. And in that respect, Zionism is also, or Canada or New Zealand or Australia, similarly, were successful. In that respect, Zionism was successful, but it was not successful as these other four in completely eliminating the native population or subjugating or taming it. The Palestinians are still there. They constitute a majority of the population, a bare majority of the population between the river and the sea, between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean, within territory entirely controlled by Israel. There are more Arabs than there are Jews. And so this is the basis of what I talk about when I talk about resistance, the fact that the Palestinians have stubbornly resisted their expulsion, their elimination as a people. And still have a national consciousness, still have, even though it's very weak, a national movement, it's weak today, and still are there contesting their own erasure.
I just want to read a question that came to me on the email. Professor Khalidi, kindly speak on how the radical Zionists have distorted the true meaning of anti-Semitism. We're running out of time, but if we have a minute or two, Professor.
If we do have a minute or two, because I have another.
Yeah.
I have another.
I know. A minute if you want.
Soon.
Okay.
Could you repeat the question, please, Summer?
Yeah. Art wants to know from you how the radical Zionists and radical Zionism have distorted the true meaning of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good question. One of the things that Israel has succeeded in doing is just normalizing itself, creating a nation state, creating a new people. And in this respect, it is both a settler colonial movement and a national movement. But that means that it's a nation state like any other, and that it should be subject to criticism like any other nation state. It proclaims itself as the nation state of the Jewish people. But that does not mean that all Jews are implicated in its actions, or that a criticism of its actions is a criticism of Jews, or is in itself anti-Semitic. And one of the sinister tactics that supporters of Israel have adopted in order to stop people from criticizing the actions of the state of Israel is to say that any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitic, or almost any criticism of Israel, or any criticism of Israel that particularly disturbs them is anti-Semitic. And they have created a whole structure whereby they argue this or that or the other is an illegitimate thing to say about Israel. And the problem is Israel is just a state. By its own declaration, it's a state, and therefore it should be subject to criticism like China's treatment of the Uyghurs, or like Turkey's suppression of freedoms, or Russia's undemocratic behavior, or whatever it may be, Russia's occupation of Crimea, whatever it may be. But the, criticizing those things when the culprit is Israel is considered, in many cases, to be anti-Semitic. And this is a completely illegitimate approach. I mean, there is virulent anti-Semitism in the world. Most of it does not come from supporters of Palestinian rights. Most of it comes from white supremacist racists who are bigots and hate Jews because they're Jews. And the issue of Israel doesn't come up.
I want to thank you, Professor Rashid Khalidi, for being on True Talk. We were talking about the 100 Years War on Palestine, a fascinating book. And I want to thank him for being on True Talk. This is WMNF Tampa, and NPR News is next.